The year is 1994, and we follow three brothers, Bill, Dave, and Alvin Firpo, who travel to the quiet town of Paradise, Pennsylvania, intending to pull off a quick bank robbery. Although the heist succeeds, their escape quickly unravels as bad weather, car trouble, and their own guilt keep trapping them in the city. As Christmas approaches, the brothers encounter kind-hearted locals whose generosity clashes with their criminal minds. This contrast highlights one of the film's main themes, the tension between greed and compassion. Nicolas Cage, John Lovitz, and Dana Carvey bring humor and personality to these brothers, each representing a different attitude towards crime and responsibility. Now, while this movie received mixed reviews, it has become a cult favorite for its lighthearted tone, wintry setting, and message about redemption and the spirit of Christmas. This week on Back the Balcony, we cover Trapped in Paradise. Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, two titans of cinematic review. Sometimes right, sometimes wrong, but always captivating. Your hosts Antonio of the Cult Worthy Cinema Podcast and Justin Henson of the Movie Wire are here to take you back to the balcony. And I think we're probably bad at math because we messed up on the calendar. We added an extra holiday film somehow. Like, we're into the new year, essentially, but we still got one more Christmas movie, so we're going to go ahead and do it before we do our two-year anniversary episode with our awards ceremony. So I hate leaving things unfinished, and that's why we are doing this film tonight. We've talked about it in the past briefly on The Cult Worthy, and I've mentioned it several times, The Cult Worthy, and it's a perfect time to do this with Siskel and Ebert's review of holiday movies, and they weren't very favorable of them, and this just happened to be one of their most hated holiday movies of all time. So I thought it would be a great opportunity to bring it to the show. We are doing Trapped in Paradise from 1994. Nicolas Cage, Dana Carvey at like his peak, John Lovitz, and an assortment of great character actors. Now, I have a very special love for this movie, but I'm not going to get into my opinion of it as a film until we get into the conversation. Of course, I have to ask you, Justin Henson, what do you think of Trapped in Paradise?
I don't know. I mean, during the holidays, you have... It's almost like standards are lowered during the holidays with me. And
100%. 100%.
If you have a good message, if you have a good redemption, you have some memorable characters, it's a pass when it comes to a Christmas movie with me. I don't love Trapped in Paradise. Did I like it? Yes. Do I watch it every other holiday? Yes, because this is one of those holiday movies I think I watch because of the love of the characters, the love of the performances. Mm-hmm. This is one of those go-to movies. If you don't love Nick Cage, Lovitz, or Carvey, you're probably not going to like this movie. And I like all three of them for their own individual talents. And yeah, you know what? It's an okay movie. The movie has vast flaws that I can spout off for 30 minutes straight. But it delivers the holiday message. It delivers the redemption quality. It does everything a Christmas movie needs to do. It's stupid fun. Hallmark made a formula to get money from these movies year over year over year. Why not Trapped in Paradise? It does the same shit.
I've been on like repeat saying this on both this show and on my other show about films that are literally just kind of locked in time. Like, you had to have been like of a certain age and persuasion when a film comes out to really appreciate it. Because if you're born too soon, you don't like it. If you're born too late, you don't get it. I think Trapped in Paradise is a perfect example of that. Like, Nicolas Cage at this point, 1994, he's not an Oscar winner yet, but he's still like a pretty big name, mainstream name. But he also does have that wild card in him of like a goofy performance. So just the year before, he had It Could Happen to You, where he's charming Nicolas Cage, right? But let's not forget that he also had Vampire's Kiss and Honeymoon in Vegas, where he's goofy Nicolas Cage. And now I think that the Nicolas Cage caricature of himself that we're so used to over, like, let's say the last 15 years, we always roll the dice with films of which Nicolas Cage are we going to get in this movie? Are we going to get serious Nicolas Cage? Like, are we going to get adaptation Nicolas Cage? Or are we going to get Wicker Man Nicolas Cage, right? It's a roll of the dice. And this, I feel, in 1994, this might be his most raw Nicolas Cage performance that we had seen yet in a film that doesn't really call for it. Like, he's just doing what he's doing. And I think the reason why is because he's got Lovitz and Dana Carvey doing what he's doing, that he feels like, well, if these two are going to play, I got to play. I like that energy. But as a critic, and as, like, let's say a mainstream audience member who's not there for that kind of humor, I can get why some people hate this movie. My mom hates this movie.
And I respect that. I respect that about you. And the one thing I will disagree with is when it comes to the 90s, this is Nick Cage's decade where we see a Nick Cage performance. And honestly, I've talked about this before in other shows, where we have the Nick Cage performance that goes on, and it's never challenging to his range, except for when he's challenged in Leaving Las Vegas. But everything else is the story, the characters revolving around him. We don't really get an exploration of Nick Cage up until, you know, we get into more recent films that we've seen in the last 5, 6, 7 years. So I think this one, we do see that same example where we see Dana Carvey and John Lovitz acting around him. But what I do love about this chemistry is it's a balance that our critics are going to, I'm going to solely disagree and we'll get into it. But I think it is a proper balance where we don't see each and every one try and outperform based on the need of the scene. We see a perfectly balanced between our trio here. And that's what I did love about the movie, and I'm going to disagree with our critics going into it, because it could have been outlandish, it could have been more slapstick, it could have been more silly, but there is no stereotypes here when it comes to how our characters perform, or even our paradise setting.
And it does kind of echo back to some of the classic films that have the very similar trope of, let's say, a bunch of escaped convicts or thieves or whatever, let's say generally bad people that make their way into a town that's overwhelmingly full of nice people, and it kind of changes who they are. Like, we've seen this many times, and that's where I disagree with the critics later on. I'm sure I'll echo myself later, but this is a tried and true formula, and it's been repurposed to kind of fit the 90s aesthetic of, let's say, movies like Groundhog Day, right? Where, like, the town wins a salty person over. So my first example is, like, We're No Angels from 1955 with Humphrey Bogart. It's practically the same plot, right? Or The Three Godfathers with John Wayne. Three crooks find a baby, and they change their ways to raise the baby. There's a Edgar G. Ulmer movie that I love called St. Benny the Dip, which is almost the exact same thing, except it's like a church instead of a small town, and they become essentially, like, makeshift priests and do-gooders, right? We like seeing that. We like seeing the people turn because it reminds us of a time that we think we know, but maybe it didn't exist. Like, maybe the It's a Wonderful Life town doesn't exist. We just think it does because we've seen movies that represent it, right? And I feel that's what this is. But there's a nostalgia to that. It's almost like a Norman Rockwell kind of thing. It's like we see the painting, and we're like, oh, those were the good old days. But were they? Like, it's just like kind of a facade. And that's what cinema's for. It makes us feel like there is a place and a time that may never really have existed. So we go to the movies to escape to that place. And I think that's what Paradise represents, right? Now, as for the three guys, I think this chemistry is great. Like, a lot of critics hated this chemistry at first. Like we said, Nicolas Cage is doing something completely on his own. He's normal 1 minute, but then he's totally manic and almost borderline crazy in certain moments. I think the most sustained performance of the three is probably Lovitz, and that's, you know, purposeful. He's the pathological liar, right? So he has to maintain a certain energy so people will believe his bullshit. And then Dana Carvey is like the Harpo of the group. He's the klepto, he's the goofiness. I've got a whole thing later. I'm going to save it for after the critics' opinions of what that is. But these three guys really work. If the movie had been just a little bit better, I would love to have seen more adventures of the Firpo brothers. I think it's a really well-crafted trio of people, not only as characters on the page, but what the performances were. It's just sad that the movie wasn't better, because I would easily watch them like I would watch a Three Stooges or a Marx Brothers movie. You know, the Firpo brothers go to the races, the Firpo brothers go to Mars. I don't know. It works for me, and maybe it's a good thing that it's self-contained to this one movie, to this one holiday, but I like what they do enough to want more of them.
And I'm going to say something that I'm going to regret, because even though I'm a huge fan of Nick Cage, I think this movie would have been better without him. And
I agree.
Because going to your point, this could have been the slapstick. We could have added another SNL character in here that really did amplify the silliness of it, because when it comes to holiday formula, you have to get the setting right. That's the primary. You don't get that right, the rest of the movie's going to suck. You have to have the feel-good environment, and it gets it here. Now, when we place a trio of criminals that are against their element, that's where things go wrong. Situational pieces go wrong, and I think that's where critics really wanted that to lean further in. That slapstick element, where we have our criminals going from one unfortunate situation to another, but it's really never fully utilized. And I think that's where Nick Cage is the real anchor here to really pull that back. And even though I love the balance between it holistically, I think Lovitz and Carvey really have to hold themselves back, because they are trying to balance it with Cage, who is that subtle piece of it to really say, this is the sanity, this is the direction, this is the moral lesson. He is the anchor to say, we are going to drive this moral lesson, and it really doesn't go anywhere. And I will agree, if I'm getting ahead of myself, with our critics, that it doesn't go anywhere, because it constantly chases itself in a circle of what it wants to be. But at the same time, this is where we lower our standards, because at the end of the day, does it tell a moral lesson? Yes. Does the filmmaking suck? Yes. Because I take one moment that drives me nuts every freaking time, and that's when we get the river scene where Dana Carvey is struggling to stay afloat, and then all of a sudden he's drowning, even though he's pulling out and breathing, and then he gets taken to a house and he's dry as a bone. So there are a lot of elements here to just say this is a horrible movie, but...
Oh, okay, well, I'll defend that later in the critics' review. But this is a question I was going to ask you. So, like, the director and writer of this, George Gallo, he wrote one of my favorite movies of all times, which is Midnight Run. And you can tell that there's a lot of Midnight Run energy in the script. It may not make it to the screen because of what the actors are doing, but there's a lot of energy in the script. For example, there's a whole side kind of quest between the two escaped convicts and the Firpo brothers' mom in a car. And the back and forth between them might be some of the funniest stuff in the movie. And then you've got the Richard Jenkins character as the FBI agent. Well, he may as well be the Yaphet Kotto character from Midnight Run, right? Like, there's a whole side thing going on with the FBI. That's some of the funniest stuff. Richard Jenkins in this movie, he's in it for 5 minutes. But each scene he's in, he's got some banger dialogue and some amazing quips. And it's just the Richard Jenkins energy that he's known for now, but maybe wasn't known for back then. That's where the whole Midnight Run stuff comes in. My question for you is, I feel that the Nicolas Cage character, that Firpo brother, I guarantee you on page, was written to be a lot more serious. That should have been the dry character. That should have been the Charles Grodin of the group. When you think about the dialogue that's delivered by Cage, so for example, there's a scene where Dana Carvey asks him in the car if they can stop for ring dings and milk. And his response was like, yeah, sure. And then maybe we'll go to the puppet show and maybe we'll get some cotton candy or whatever. And the way that Nicolas Cage delivers it is really snarky, almost matching Carvey's energy. But in my mind, if I was to read those lines and hear it as Charles Grodin, it would almost be like his character from Clifford, just very dry, very sarcastic. And I think that's the way it was written. There was a lot of behind-the-scenes conflict where Nicolas Cage did not want to take direction. And you can tell. you can definitely tell this movie goes off the rails. That's part of its charm, in my opinion, but I don't think it matches the filmmaker's original vision or the scripts. So I always wonder what the alternate universe version of this movie is.
It would have been a Grodin. It would have been almost a Steve Martin to an extent with just pure sarcasm. So, and right. I think that's where the mix match is we have our trio here that really don't know how to react to each other. And Cage, and I'll state it again, I love Cage, even in his linear performances, but this one, I think he really does not get the material. We needed sarcasm. We needed something dry. We needed that kind of drive to bounce back of our SNL cast. So I think that's where the misdirection was, is this one, even though at the end of the day, the chemistry works to an extent of how it matches the setting and the people of the town. But when it comes to the three of them, we don't really care by the time we get to the climax how they are, how their redemption story goes. We care more for the town. And that says a lot for the direction of it, of the feeling of the moral aspects of Christmas, is we care more for the people of the town than we do the redemption of our criminals. And that could have been a huge piece of it. If we take Cage out, put somebody that is super dry, super comedic, and really drive that piece of it, because comedy can be that relatable factor that really pushes us over the edge of something memorable. And we don't get Trapped in Paradise as one of those top of mind holiday movies that is on a watch list.
I mean, 94, it's a tiny bit early, but it could have even been 90s Clooney in that role. He could have handled it a very dry way as well. Yeah, I think that is the biggest problem with the movie when it comes to the full package of it, how critic would see it and how a lot of audiences saw it, that the energy doesn't feel right. It doesn't match the page, but I like what it is anyway. The chaos of it really appeals to me. Okay, so let's talk about what a great cast of side characters, however, are in this movie. That seems to be a trope with 90s films like this. You know, Groundhog Day had an amazing assortment of characters in this little small town. They would bring it to life. And this one does the exact same. Well, I need to start with Florence Stanley first as Ma Furpo. I mean, essentially, she's like the Beagle Brothers' mom, right? She doesn't care that they're criminals. In fact, she kind of supports it. You know, I miss the days when we used to have big screen TVs in the house. Like, I loved her character. Like I said, her rapport with the ex-convicts is some of the funniest stuff in the movie. Donald Moffat from The Thing, of course, as the bank president. He's fantastic. We got Angela Patton, who was in Groundhog Day, as his wife. Mrs. A, great. All of the faces that we see from like B-movies and genre pictures as the sheriff, the deputy, all these people are fantastic. But, I hate to say it, major miscast, Mad Chinomic in this movie. And I love Mad Chinomic, right? I'm a Twin Peaks fan. I'm a Sleepwalkers fan. She does not belong in this movie.
No, and I think me and you are on the same page here. And I think this is where my biggest problem of being not memorable really falls to the line, is because we have all these side characters that do a great job. Richard Jenkins is one of those actors so underrated, and he has been presented major roles, and we still haven't seen his career take off after that. This one really paints a picture of, when we see him on screen, this is where the direction of the movie should have gone, where we see him bitching about his Christmas Eve dinner, shooting tires off of other police cars. And this is where I think the movie is a misfire, is we have all this chaos. We have all these side characters, and we never fully recognize the talent they're bringing to the table. And Richard Jenkins, I love this man so much as a side character, that I really wanted this movie to be surrounded around him and his chase of our trio of criminals. This would have been one of those holiday journey movies that really would have painted a picture of redemption. Have these two, or have these four, really reunite after the fact. And we get to that climax, and we do get a little bit of that, but it feels unearned because we don't get enough side characters, because there are so many of them. They all have their one-liners that are memorable in this movie, but we don't go far enough when it comes to how it builds to the climax or builds to the stakes of this film.
I'm totally accepting of, let's say, pre-politically correct filmmaking and storytelling. Mid-90s up, they got a lot better about it, but there is a place, I guess you can say, in cinema of the past where you can have someone that's mentally challenged as a side character, almost used as a comedic side note, a one-note joke that kind of just makes his way through the movie, or their way, I should say. This movie fucks up and puts two of them in there. You've got the store owner and his slow, dim-witted, mentally challenged brother, cousin, whatever he is. And then you've got the sheriff and his mentally challenged, slow son, who's the deputy. It hurts the movie to have two butts of the joke of being slow and mentally challenged. And that's been my biggest problem. I'm not saying that they should even be in there at all. But one, we've seen enough films do the one and kind of get away with it. And for the most part, we give it a pass. This movie does two. And I think two is, for one, two too many. But especially when it's like the same kind of mental challenge, the same kind of neurodiversity that they make the same joke of in two separate characters, I think that damages the credibility of your movie. So that's my biggest complaint of the film.
And I think that's the biggest stereotype. It actually adds to the story of this small town, right?
If it was the one.
But it's two. But yeah. And we go into everything else of the film where we get, and I think I go back to what's at top of mind when we get Nicolas Cage, when he is at the train station and he gets that old lady that's willing to pay for himself. If it was any other movie, this would have been a stereotypical beehive hair kind of waitress type single mom that is giving her money out. But we don't get that here. We do get those stereotypes. And it's one of those that we don't see in movies now because they're a lot more careful of having that mental illness added as a comedic element because right. It's not really funny. It really isn't. It adds a goofiness to the storyline that nobody finds funny. It's just easy. It's just lazy screenwriting. And it really doesn't add any relevance to where the story is going to go. It's, you might as well take that idea and make it a cartoon because we don't add any of the characters of arc. We don't add any development to it. It's just thrown in as if I don't know where to take this story. I don't know where to take this transition.
Right. It's lazy.
It's lazy. That's all it is.
Right. And if that's the thing, is like so many movies pre mid to late 90s were so guilty of that, where the stereotypical butt of a joke could be a gay person. It could be a mentally challenged person. I mean, up until only 10, 15 years ago, overweight people were the easy target. And they've really kind of, scaled back on that. So I think that is one of my biggest complaints about the movie. But other than that, like I love the attempt. Like I said, I'm going to save my biggest stuff for after the critique. So let's go ahead and get into that. This was brought by Roger.
That's John Lovitz and Dana Carvey as two brothers appearing before their parole board in Trapped in Paradise. And boy, am I glad I didn't finish my list of the year's worst films before I saw this one. It's so bad, it approaches a state of total inertia. The movie occasionally seems to shake itself awake and try again, but it's about nothing, and it's about nobody, and it's a comedy only in the wildest dreams of the people connected with it. When the convicts get out of prison, they're met by a third brother, played by Nicolas Cage. He has managed to go straight so far in life. Through plot twists too boring to explain, they end up in Pennsylvania, casing a potential bank for robbery. Trapped in Paradise is dead in the water right from its first scenes, with Carvey producing an obnoxious twerp accent, and Lovitz able to be obnoxious even without the accent. The plot is absurd, but even worse, it's exhausted. There are times when everyone in this movie seems to want to curl up and die or go out for a sandwich, and only sheer professionalism or a paycheck keeps them plugging away at a screenplay as contrived as it is stupid. You want to see a movie about crooks in a small town who stumble into the Christmas spirit? Rent a picture from earlier this year called The Ref. It's a lot better than this one.
Which we already covered a couple weeks ago. So at least he gave more credit to The Ref.
Where do you want me to start? Because I have three major points based on this. Do you want me to start with Dana Carvey? Do you want me to start with the plot? Or do you want me to start with the, like, let's say the whole story of the picture?
I'm going to play the wild card and say, let's start with Lovitz, who has made a career of being annoying. That's why he was picked for this role. He is obnoxious. He is that one guy that you look upon to be obnoxious. So I would start there, of pure intent of casting.
Well, I mean, Lovitz, I can honestly say I've never seen play anything but Lovitz in any movie. Like, it's that's you hire him for that. So to expect anything other than what he's bringing, that's shame on you, because this is all he does. This is his lane.
100%. But let's go into and keep top of mind, this came out with the release of The Santa Claus, which I believe they didn't like as well. So this is one that you have two completely different holiday feelings. And this, I would go into, let's talk about the storytelling piece of it. Let's talk about the boredom. Let's talk about the everybody wants to shoot themselves or kill themselves or go out for a sandwich, because I think that's not relevant here, because I will agree at this point that the movie does chase itself. It does have moments where it feels like it's trying to find relevance of what it wants to do to prove a point. I will agree with that. But in no way will I agree with the casting here when it comes to how our cast interacts.
Okay, so yeah, let's start with it. The storytelling, it chasing itself. I agree with Roger in the fact that it does seem like it's chasing itself. This is where Antonio gets to come out for real. The reason why it feels that way is because it really is just an amalgamation of classic movies that do all the same things. Of course there's going to be someone who falls in the river. Of course there's going to be an animal in danger. Of course the town is going to come together and lie to protect these thieves that have turned another cheek or a new leaf, for example. All of this is very traditional and stereotypical. And here's the thing. The movies that it's referencing and copying are classics. And again, it always blows my mind that even if these two guys recognize that they never say it in their reviews. Once in a while, they say, oh, it's a ripoff of Ghostbusters, or it's a ripoff of this. But this literally is a major ripoff of some classic cinema. And they don't even give that point to it, where it's like, the movie chases itself and everyone wants to leave. It's like, okay, well, are you even going to mention that the movie just feels like a handful of classic films thrown together? Even as an insult, I'd respect it, because that's what it is. There's no denying that that's exactly what this movie is. It is so stereotypical in its tropes of classic cinema that pretty much everyone knows. All the characters are facsimiles. They bring some actors bring originality to those characters, but they're all facsimiles of previous things. So I think that argument is a little moot in the sense that, like, they're not giving the examples I expect from these cinema brains, right?
Well, I think it really does beg that question of, should we lower standards if it's a holiday movie, if it's a Christmas movie? Should we lower the standards of the filmmaking process if it delivers a message? And, you know, we go even up to today where holiday movies have just been beaten to death. Hallmark nailed that coffin years ago, and we're getting the same stuff over and over again. But you know what? The feelings, how they present and surface the feelings is one thing. But when it comes to the 90s, this is where I would say we should lower our standards if it's a Christmas movie. Because when it comes to at the end of the, by the time the climax rolls, did you feel something? Did you feel the holiday redemption? Did you feel all the feels of what we should be treating our fellow man with Christmas spirit? That's where I think we do need to stop taking our cinema hats off and really focus on the feeling of a movie. Yes, we have tropes. Yes, we have cliches. Guess what? Christmas movies are gonna be cliche, because there's only so much you can do with a Christmas movie. So we have the three guys that want redemption. You have the bank robbery. You have three guys lifting a horse out of a frozen lake just to get to the point that they are there because they have morals that aren't seen on a surface level that we got from the beginning. The point is a mere intent. We've talked about this 100,000 times, that the intent has to be there, and the intent is here on what it wants to portray. Did I get a feeling by the time the credits rolled? Absolutely. I did feel that we felt redemption for our three criminals. And saying that statement out loud and questioning myself and my own opinion, that is a success when it comes to a Christmas movie. You know what? You don't have to be a critic and just go full on that the filmmaking sucks, because the filmmaking sucks here. I get that. But when it comes to the mere feeling of it, I think it does do a mild successful job on it.
Let's talk about Dana Carvey now, because notoriously, many people, especially critics, when this movie came out, hated what Dana Carvey was doing. Now, not I'm going to say in preparation for this episode, but I've just been curious over the last couple of weeks, knowing that it was on the list, what other people thought of it. And I've been listening to some podcasts or watching some clips or some YouTube reviews of it. And I feel that there's a reevaluation of what Dana Carvey's character is in this, and that they realized that he is probably the funniest person in the movie when you watch it from a different context. Like, his lines are the most quotable lines. His physical business is the best physical business in the movie. I mean, Cage does some stuff, but it's wild and outlandish, almost as if the director or the cameraman even didn't know it was coming. But there's like a controlled chaos to what Carvey is doing, and I think it's brilliant. And there's another reason why I think it's brilliant, too. I've thought this for years, that this character of Alvin Firpo that Dana Carvey is doing in this movie, in my opinion, is, let's say, his Saturday Night Live take of young Mickey Rourke. His hair, his squint, his little pursed lip, and his accent is what I would expect is if Dana Carvey was doing young Mickey Rourke on Saturday Night Live, and he maintains it all the way through. And ever since I've started watching this movie with that viewpoint, it changes everything about how I feel about this performance. I need to play you something. This is Mickey Rourke, circa 1985.
Hey, what if I don't, huh? What are you gonna do? You gonna suspend me? What's that gonna look like in the papers, Commissioner? You tell me. First, you suspend the most decorated cop in the city. Second, you call off an investigation into the Chinese mafia. What's it gonna look like? You tell me, Commissioner.
My name's Alvin Firpo. And, what I've learned in prison is that, like, robbing and stealing and all that horse shit, there's something that ain't right about it, you know what I mean? A lot of guys in here disagree with me, but, they're serving time. I'm up for parole.
You take that an octave higher, and this is from Year of the Dragon, he's got the exact same hair. I can tell that Dana Carvey's like, make me look like Mickey Rourke in Year of the Dragon. And he takes that exact same cadence, and he just takes it up a notch up to here, and it's Mickey Rourke.
I don't want to insult Dana Carvey here, because I think, you know what?
Too late.
Yeah, too late. Because it is an adorable performance, but it reminded me of waking up in the middle of the night with your kid shining a flashlight in your eyes. Because you got to remember, without Lovitz and Cage, this performance is, Dana Carvey's performance is amplified based on the chemistry that we have. And Lovitz and Cage have a subtle performance. And then you have Carvey, that's the only cartoonish real character in the movie.
Well, yeah. It's a Marx Brothers. Like, that's why, like, Cage needs to be more serious so he can be the Groucho character. And then, essentially, Lovitz is like the Chico, the wise ass, the snarky, annoying one who has a lot of one-liners. And then Carvey would be the Harpo. He'd be the silly, bouncy, flighty one. Like, that's a dynamic. And I feel that, like, if Cage was just a little bit more serious, or if we had another actor in there, I feel the dynamic would round itself out the way it was supposed to. But, like I said, There's a weird chaos here where the formula doesn't work, but it does something different, and I like what it does. It's different. It's like, oh shit, I got peanut butter on my chocolate. It's not supposed to go together, but it works.
It does work, and I think when it comes to the chemistry, it feels like it works on if we were settling, but it does feel like we have things that are just needing to be inserted in between each of the three. that really would take this to a next level. And Carvey, I'm not going to say it's a bad performance, you know, and that's something I'm not going to say from Dana Carvey, because most of his movies are some of my most hated movies on my list. But, you know, I think this one, he does a good job on trying to stand out. He does a good job on staying above the rest. I mean, when we talked Trapped in Paradise, when we brought it to the table, Dana Carvey was at top of mind, not Nick Cage. And that says something right. When it comes to
that's me. Yeah. Too.
And that says something on how he contributes to a movie, knowing that he has to be above Nick Cage. He has to be above Levitt, and he has to be, he's the kind of the bottom of the totem pole when it comes to the three, but he's at the top of the list when it comes to where the movie stands.
Okay. Oh, God, you're going to make us do Master of Disguise, aren't you? I just smell it. I smell it in the water.
Here's a little hint. That is hands down my most fucking hated movie of all time, and I will never, never bring that to any list possible. I hate that movie.
I won't bring it to the show either. It's not even going on the cult worthy. I do have an appreciation for Pistachio Disguisey, but we are not going to put the movie on the list.
I will cancel any appearance if that appears on any list.
I'll get Josh Gar to do it with me. All right, here we go. Here's Gene coming in.
It is.
A lot better.
So is any picture. This is a pretty bad film. Okay. And I think what's really annoying is Dana Carvey and John Lovitz. These are guys from sitcom TV or from sketch TV, Saturday Night Live, and they're playing in a whole other movie, in a whole other style than Nicolas Cage, one of our very finest actors. Mm-hmm. In fact, the relationship that's hinted at in this film between Nicolas Cage and Machen Amick could be as appealing as it could happen to you with Bridget Fonda.
Sure.
These are two wonderful movie actors, and you've got these two TV performers who are winking and blinking at the screen, not realizing that their acting style is totally inappropriate for feature films.
They don't understand the long run. They don't understand the arc of a movie. If they can get through a line and it has and it feels like a punchline, they're satisfied. And you're right about that, because in little tiny doses, like three words maybe, Dana Carvey's accent might be acceptable. But by the end of this movie, I mean,
oh no!
Even Carvey himself probably isn't able to stand
the first reel. You're ticked off at them,
okay?
And that's really a nice attitude to have to a comedy. Angry.
I mean, there's really not much you can say about their saltiness. They just don't like movies like this, and they don't get movies like this. But that's okay. It's not for them, and that's again the juxtaposition of our show, where there's lots of movies that we feel like, that movie was for me, but that's not a critic's job to determine what movie is for what person. They're looking at it from their point of view, and is it worth your money? And baseline, is this a good movie? Is it worth your $10, $15, whatever? I can't disagree with them that this is not recommendable for a theatrical experience to new audience members. Just like so many movies that I appreciate, this is a movie that you have to be tempered in. This is a movie that you have to grow up with and get and laugh at and appreciate. And I could recommend this movie to somebody else and they'll probably hate it. But if I invite them to my home with maybe a few other people and we watch it and I know all the fucking dialogue and so I quote, oh my God, guns. There's a shared experience that might be magnetic to other people. So it's really a matter of circumstance, how you view this movie and with whom. But I can't disagree that this is not a recommendable movie for a theatrical experience that's going to cost you money.
I think this is going to be our biggest agreement when it comes to a movie, because I 100% agree. Is I will never recommend this movie because all the elements don't work. Like I said in the beginning, you're watching this movie because you have a love of Cage, Lovitz, or, you know, the trio, whatever it may be. So this one, nothing here proves a point for critics to like. If a critic did like this movie, I would question it at this time if this was released today, because it really is symbolic to how you want to feel during the holidays. If you want that cheesiness cliche, the redemption, yeah, you're going to look at that messaging and say, this made me feel good. This is a movie that doesn't 100% make you feel good, but it does a decent enough job to send the message to make you have an average feeling. And that, to me, this is an average movie. This is an average holiday movie. And again, I will watch it every other year. This isn't on my top five of holiday movies every year. But again, I can't disagree with any of the critics or any of the reviews that it was released at the time, because they're absolutely right. But it's a Christmas movie. It sends a Christmas message. And when I'm looking at a Christmas movie, I'm looking at the message. I'm not looking at the filmmaking. So I will say it's a okay Christmas
movie. And we've talked about this on the Cultworthy a few years ago. We did a Christmas special and I brought this and Mixed Nuts, and you hate Mixed Nuts and I love Mixed Nuts. So again, it's something that I feel like you have to be tempered in, but it's also like, this is the best way I can describe it. I think there's something that's weirdly ironic about listening or watching the same stand-up comedy routine more than once. Like, if you know the joke and you know the punchline and you know the delivery and the timing, how is it still exciting and funny the more and more you watch it? It's just a completely a personal experience. Like, I could watch a George Carlin or a Dennis Leary special from the 90s over and over again because it's like a song. I know the punchline. I know the timing. I know the inflection. This movie is the same for me. If I didn't know it already and like it so much and know what the punchline is, I can't wait to say that line, then there is no replay value. That's why I say, like, you have to just be an appreciator of it and know it, because there's no point in rewatching it over and over again unless it just is in tune with you. You know, like, there's so many comedy specials I'll never have to watch again because I heard it, I laughed at the joke once, and I don't care to hear it again. It's the magnetism of the performer that I want to watch again. You know, like, George Carlin's jokes were hilarious, but they were all kind of the same joke. It was the delivery. It was the performance. It was the inflection and the energy that I want to see over and over and over again. And that's how I feel about the characters in this movie, not necessarily the movie itself.
And I think that's the whole point, is the ensemble here really does deliver. Like, when I talked about earlier, the story and the characters revolving around Nick Cage, that's kind of what we see here. We do see the ensemble kind of dance around Nick Cage, and the side characters are so memorable in their reactions, their delivery, their performances. So when I think of Trapped in Paradise, you know, I don't think of our trio. I think of all the characters surrounding them, because that's what actually right. makes the feeling of the movie. That's what actually brings it all together. And that's where, again, I think our critics really did recognize that our main focal point of our characters, our robbers, didn't drive the movie. The community did, the side characters did, the performances did, to really drive that Christmas feeling. And that's the reason this goes from an average movie to what could have been a poor movie.
And with Gene's review, I obviously hated the movie. I don't blame him for hating it. It's not a terrible review on his point. And again, this is one of those reviews that really kind of, he doesn't have a whole lot to say if he's not leading the episode like Roger is. So with what he has to deliver, I'm going to give him a B. And the reason why I'm giving him a B is because he brings up how much he disliked the ref, and he's wrong. So if he would have left the ref alone, he might have gotten an A from me, because I can't dispute his opinion of the movie.
And the fact that Roger brought up the ref, I'm going to give him a little bit of credit on that, too.
You should.
Because Roger nails the points. He's not wrong. And I think we both agree between our two critics, he's not wrong. He gives the exact examples that I can identify with, that it chases itself. It doesn't really know where to go. I really wish we would have had more subtext from Roger on what contributed to that. And we see that in his written review. But when it comes to the 2-minute review on TV, I get it. He's limited. But I think he nails all the key points when it comes to those looking for a holiday movie. But I just wish one of the two would have identified that this is a damn Christmas movie. And standards need to be, is it a successful feeling during December? And
right. I mean, Christmas movies get a free pass on so many
it
things.
It really does.
Because it's the spirit of
it is. And, you know, I'm probably gonna get some backlash on saying that it's cinema. You have to keep it all equal. But guess what? It's Christmas time. It's a Christmas movie. So shut the fuck up. It's all about how you feel. And this one, I think I'm going to give Roger, based on his key points, I have to give him 3 stars.
Yeah, 3 stars. I like it. I think it's good. Again, like, I don't have to hate the guys because they don't like a movie that I technically like. But like I said, I can be a consciously objective and say it's not a good movie. I just like it. So yeah. Okay, good conversation. Okay, so next week is the big week, everybody. Next week is our 2-year anniversary episode, and we are going to be doing our season 2 awards show to commemorate it, where we will put together our list of best actor, actress, director, and film, as well as the worst of the same categories. And then, of course, our favorite and least favorite reviews of our judges, of our critics. I take Gene, he takes Roger. We discuss what our favorite review of theirs was the year was, and which was our least favorite. It's literally my favorite time of the year. I went back and listened to last year's episode, and it was such a good episode, and just the nostalgia was so thick. Like, oh wow, that was literally like 2 years of movies that we watched ago, that we did that award ceremony. Now we're doing another one. Crazy.
I can't believe we've already done 200 movies, 200 reviews of Siskel and Ebert. So I've gone back and listened to a couple of them so far, and I think I might retract some of my previous statements. So it's going to be a good conversation.
Interesting. I have not done that. I only went back and listened to the award show because I wanted to remember what the categories were, because I forgot what we had done. But there are some opinions where I'm like wondering, was I right on that one? I might have to go back and do that. So yeah, excellent. So anyway, everyone, thank you for lasting 2 years with us. 100 episodes, 2 years, and our award shows next week. Tune in, and if you have the time, I know there's only a week in advance, let us know if there are any reviews that you think should win Best Review of the Year, or what your favorite films or performances of the year of season 2 were. Let us know, and I'll put it in the liner notes to read. So anyway, I'm Antonio, host of the Cult Worthy Cinema Podcast. You can find all my stuff over at thecultworthy.com. You can find my co-host, Justin Henson, over at
themoviewire.com.
And we'll see you next week.
See you next week.